Hey everybody, welcome to Cage My IQ. As always, I am your host, D-Baked. Joining with me once again is my co-host, Miles. How's it going, Miles?
Yo, doing good, doing good. A little later than usual, but doing good.
Yeah. As you guys can see, we are not live. We are pre-recording this. I had stuff that I had to do right before we came on, so we're pre-recording this. So look for it on social media, and of course, and if you're already watching this, we are recapping UFC Fight Night, Islam Makhachev, who faced off against Thiago Moises. What did you think of this card when you watched it?
Yeah, this was a pretty underrated card. This was actually, like, really good. We didn't have a single fight that went to decision. It was all finishes on the main card, so it was a fun time.
Oh, yeah. Cool. And then another thing was that there was only 10 fights on the card. There's 5 prelim and 5 fights on the main card. So it actually went pretty quickly for the amount of time that it started. It started late here at 8:30.
Yeah, it was like 9 here. Yeah.
So, but it still got done at the normal time. So for all that, I thought it was pretty good. But as you can see here, UFC Vegas 31 recap, the title is What's Next for Islam. We will get into that later on in the main event. But as always, we are Cage My IQ, the best place for MMA content. You can follow us at Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, and Twitch at the handles to the left. We are now with the Fighters First Network now on YouTube. So all you got to do is subscribe if you haven't already on our new network. Go to www.youtube.com/fightersfirst. Subscribe to the page. All of our stuff is in the Cage My IQ folder in the playlist. And then for all of our preview stuff, you just go to the Cage My IQ clips that I cut. So check us out on there. Give us a like on the video that we have right now, and then give us a comment. Let us know what you think. The question of the video will be, what is next for Islam Makhachev? So let us know what you think. And then now that we're getting going, before we get started, I just want to let you guys know, of course, each and every week we have merch now. All you do to get the merch is go to www.fightersfirst.shop. Scroll down to the Cage My IQ collection, click there, and check out our 3 shirts. It's basically one shirt in 3 different styles. We got normal, we got vintage, and then we got old. And then, you know, so if you're the type of person that wears hoodies, just go grab one, get ready for the fall. We got fall coming up in a couple of months, so now is the time to do it. And just let us know what you think of all the merch we have right now. We're going to be adding to the collection later in the year. So definitely check back from time to time. And then get your Cage My IQ merch right now. Now's the time to get it. But let's get started with the first fight on the card that we have on here. This was actually one of my favorite fights. Probably, to me, the fight of the night on the main card. It was a matchup that was between men's featherweight matchup between Billy Quarantino, who defeated Gabriel Benitez by third round TKO. In this matchup, Billy Quarantino moved to 16-3, 4-1 in UFC, whereas Gabriel Benitez fell to 22-9, 6-5 in the UFC. What did you see in this matchup?
All right, yeah, this one was a real banger. I had it as a clean sweep for Quarantino in every round. But Benitez had his moments. Like at the beginning of the first, he invested early on the legs, but then he got knocked down, you know, within like, what, 30 seconds? And then after that, it was pretty much just all Quarantino. He took his back for like 3 minutes. Like they got up at the last, like, what, 10 seconds, 20 seconds? Like there was a very little bit of time left, but that back take with those body triangles, that was a huge problem for Benitez in this fight. Like, he just didn't seem to really have any answers for that, because it was the same thing. Second round, Quarantino just opened up right away with the takedown, got that body triangle, and then took the back and just was kind of working on him, looking for submissions, but just kind of wearing down with punches from the back. And even when Benitez would find his way out and they would get back to the feet, The exchanges were not one-sided enough for him to get ahead on the cards and significant strikes. At best, they were even. And then when Quarantino turned up the volume, he basically took control on the feet. But I mean, yeah, that whole eye thing, the eye situation going on was really bad. It was about caught that big punch in the first and then that jumping, the flying knee in the second. Like, oh, it was probably most likely a broken orbital. But yeah, that's why they had to end it in the third, because it was just getting so bad, which is why we had a very rare finish from Quarantino, which was a finish from the back position with punches, because the ref was like, all right, that's it. He's not defending, and that eye's going to swell shut completely. So yeah, I thought it was a pretty fun fight. Very interesting. If not, a little bit kind of like routine, like there was kind of the same behaviors over and over and over again. But I mean, that's kind of how you got to win fights. If you find a weakness in your opponent's game, that's what you double down on, you know? So that was really fun to watch. But he called out Charles Rosa. Quarantino wants Charles Rosa right now, which, I mean, stylistically, I don't mind that matchup. But at best, they're in the same area, like rank-wise, so it wouldn't like move him ahead any. At worst, Charles Rosa might actually be behind him with this victory. So like that wouldn't make sense to fight down. I personally think a better matchup might be Hakeem Dawodu or Sheng-Wu Choi. Either one of those guys, I think, would be a banger.
Yeah, I thought the big thing with this matchup was the pace. I think the pace and the movement was easily in Billy Q's favor. And then, of course, I thought that Benitez was going to have a better showing, because I thought that he was going to be able to then get his game plan going. But it was just obvious from the get-go that Billy Q dictated the pace. He got his wrestling involved, which was a huge thing. And then I think blending up Benitez early on was a big factor with the round. I think it was after round one, he was all bloodied up in the face. Mm-hmm. And then the only time I felt like Benitez had a chance was early on in the third, when he knocked him, I believe, he knocked him good.
He knocked him down. He got a knockdown in the third. It was a solid, I think it was a cross, but he was too tired. He couldn't finish.
I thought he was going to do it, but yeah, he was too tired to continue on with that, to keep the momentum going, and then allowed Billy Q to come back, do what he did best, with smother Benitez, and then it was just a matter of time before he was just too tired to do anything, and Quarantino finished him off later in the third. But it was definitely a good showing for Billy Q. Like, I thought stylistically it was going to be a really good matchup, which for Benitez, even though like he looked like that, he was still able to keep the fight going. I thought he might have gotten finished early, but he was able to at least keep it going into the third. But that gas tank was just so worn out by the wrestling and the clinching that maybe if he would have avoided early on, he might have been able to change the trajectory of the fight. But he wasn't. Mm-hmm. Billy Q picks the win up and moves on. I agree with you. I don't know about Charles Rosa. Maybe, like you said, Dawodu would be a better choice, or somebody else. But he definitely should be going up and not kind of sideways.
Yeah, I mean, just depending, like the ranks the rankings I saw, they're not always 100%, but there's a big enough spread between them to where the official rankings are probably really, really close, to where they're only like two spots apart, above or below. Whereas like Dawodu and Sheng-Wu Choi, they're closer to the high 20s, above that into like the low 15 area. Versus Charles Rosa on here is all the way down at like 40. And where is he at? Billy Q is somewhere in like 30s right now. So like at best, they're too close together for that to make sense. But if he were to fight up, I think there's some guys on here who would be like real banging, like real banger shows. Like Andre Feely is free right now. I know he just fought. He needs a little recovery time, but like, that might be an interesting one. He looked really good in that last fight.
Before the crazy stoppage because of the poke. But he would definitely be a good guy to fight, because he's going to be really eager to get back into the octagon after that crazy events in that fight, because he was winning that fight, and then it just sucks that he wasn't able to get the victory because of it.
I think he's definitely chomping at the bit for another fight as soon as possible, and this might be a good one.
Yep. But let's move on to the second fight on the main card. We had a middleweight matchup, which saw Rodolfo Vieira pick up a victory over Dustin Stolfus by third round submission in this fight. Vieira moved to 8-1 overall, 3-1 in UFC, whereas Stolfus to 13-3, 0-2 in the UFC. What did you see with this matchup?
This was another banger right here. Round one was pretty even, I thought. It could kind of go either way. The question was, did the judges think that that big knee and that kind of rush of activity from Stolfus there at the end, was that enough to steal the round? Because the whole round, Vieira was looking great. Like, he was looking really good on the stand-up with his combinations. About 2 minutes in, Stolfus started to build some steam, and, you know, he was striking back, but he put Vieira on the defensive, which means he started using that jab, and he just put Stolfus on the bad end of that jab, set it up, put in some solid counters crosses after that, and really put him on his back foot for the majority of the round after that. It was just those last, 30 seconds or something like that there at the end, where Stolfus kind of picked it up a little bit. Was it enough to steal the round? I'm not sure. But the other two rounds were pretty securely for Vieira, I thought, even if he didn't get the finish. The second round was all Vieira. He shot and immediately got that takedown, and Stolfus was able to work back to the feet. There was some heavy blows, but again, Vieira just kept Stolfus at distance with that jab and his combinations. And I mean, it was a firefight, but I think Vieira was definitely coming out ahead, especially when you factor in his takedown. And he would be working on the ground whenever he could have some control time. He was working on getting punches in, not just working for submissions, which would, you know, put him ahead on the scorecards for significant strikes. And then the third is when he got his finish, and Stolfus kind of came out pretty strong. I think he was nervous. He probably assumed he was too behind, and got it. Vieira got in that takedown, though, controlled him from the top position, kind of worked a little bit of ground and pound. Stolfus got back to his feet and then tried that guillotine choke, which I think that was the big mistake he made in that round, was just unnecessarily creating a ground fighting situation for no reason, because he wasn't going to get a guillotine choke from that position on Vieira. There's just no way. He's too good. It's, of course, he just slipped his head out. And then once they got back to the feet, that was the end. Vieira took the back, because when they were getting up, he was like, oh, I want to be back here. So that as soon as it got to the feet, he swung around, got that rear naked choke. And that was all she wrote. But very good performance for Vieira. And I know they were saying that he's a very nervous fighter, and he was very kind of skittish coming into this fight, or even the last few fights. But this is the fight where he looked the most comfortable, the most at home in the octagon, and definitely showed. So I'm hoping he can keep that going, because, fight stress, it's a real bitch. And if you let it get to you, it'll ruin a good thing. And right now his record is excellent. It's 8-1 now. Hopefully he can pull out some more wins in the future. My question is, where are they going to put him next? Because there's some guys I would like to see Vieira match up with, but there's so many people in the middleweights right now, especially in that neck of the woods, that are already booked up. So some of these really good matchups that I'd want to see, they're already taken right now. The one guy who's free right now, who might be it would be a good matchup, and I think probably a fairly easy win for him, maybe Roman Dolatze. You know, the guy who Dolatze came off of a win by riding a dude's back for three rounds. Yeah, put him with that guy. Let's see if he can ride Vieira's back for three rounds.
The crazy thing with that is, I just saw that they booked Stropoli, the guy that he beat.
Yeah.
And I thought he was out. I thought he was going to get his walking papers, but no, they booked him.
Jimmy Pickett.
Booked him. So I'm like, damn, this guy has.
Oh, he's
nine
fighting
lives.
Down a lot, though. He's fighting down to the bottom. This dude's got an 0-2 record. That's the bottom of the division. So if he don't make this one, he's moving. Yeah.
But I watched this fight. I was so adamant going into it. I'm like, you he puts a lot into that first round. Like most of the time, he either wins 10-9 or 10-8 because he's very dominant with the grappling, but then he gasses himself out because he goes basically gung-ho in that round, and it's either like submission or bust for him. But in this fight, he showed his poise. He took his time. He was still doing what he usually does. He just didn't use turbo boost in the first round. He just weathered it, was able to get into the second, get into the third. He didn't he looked a little bit tired, but he didn't look as tired as he usually does. But he basically just capitalized on the mistakes that Stolfus made. I went into this. I'm like, what Stolfus needs to do is throw a lot of leg kicks in the first round and just keep moving and then see how Vieira is going to do. And if he keeps moving in, just avoid it, throw a kick, avoid it, throw a kick. But he didn't really do that. He came in with the wrong game plan. And then just like you said, it gets into the third. It could have been 1-1, but he makes a mistake. I kind of had it 2-0.
Had it a little bit more for Vieira in the first, just because he was doing all the work, you know?
Yeah.
That little bit at the end. Based on what we know about judging, the judges may have given it to him, but I don't know if he deserved it.
And then he just makes that mistake, and Vieira capitalized. And then that's why he loses by the submission. You don't go for submission against a submission specialist, because this is the guy that's going to know how to reverse things, get out of submissions, because that's his game, grappling and submissions. And he made him pay for it. So, other than the last fight, which he lost, that's the only blemish that he had, where I believe it was Anthony Hernandez and made him pay when Vieira was winning that fight up until that point. It looks like he's learned his lesson. And then he did, from what I think, he changed his striking coach too, which had a good effect on this fight. So if he can continue this movement up with his striking and then his cardio, he might be a good player in the future if he just keeps on making these small steps because of that grappling. He's just I'm not saying he's Royce Gracie or something, but he's up there. He's up there kind of like what's his name?
Diego Ferreira?
Yeah.
The lightweights?
Yeah, just like Vieira. Then not on the level of the jiu-jitsu master in the welterweights.
Oh, Olivier? Oh, welterweights. Let me see.
Yeah.
Hold on.
he just lost to...
Gilbert Burns. Wait.
No, not him. Well, not him.
Michael Chiesa?
He just lost to...
Damian Maia?
Yeah, Damian Maia.
Okay.
Yeah.
All those guys are really good.
I just had a brain fart for the moment. I knew it started with the M, but Damian Maia. Damian Maia, I think he's on his way to that, but I think his striking might actually be better moving forward than Maia's, because Maia's the striking was never his strong point. But I hope that for me right now, he has a ceiling of maybe the top 10, maybe to get to 10. But if he can prove his striking, that'll dictate how much farther he goes in the division.
Yeah, I mean, he's not bad. There's some guys coming up that I think could really be a problem because of how credentialed their background is. But I think they might be kind of putting their eggs in the wrong basket. Like we were talking about Gregory Rodriguez, the last guy we saw fight from, I think he was coming from LFA, I think, coming in. And he was really investing heavy on that striking when he was fighting Dusko Todorovic. That was the fight. And it was but it's both of these guys have excellent grappling backgrounds, but they need to use it a lot more. You know, the striking's good. You do need that in the middleweights, but you've got an asset that not many middleweights have right now. You got Heinisch, you've got, let's see, Gastelum when he decides he wants to, Hermanson can grapple, Vettori can grapple, Brunson, wrestler.
Whitaker.
Costa can, but he never does. So it's like, do we even count that? He's like Kevin Gastelum, but worse. Like, he refuses. Yeah. He's like, no, I believe in my hands. No, stop believing in your hands. It's not gonna work for you. But I mean, like, there's a lot of guys here who mostly just rely on striking. And I mean, if these guys really came heavy with that jiu-jitsu and blended it well with the striking, to kind of use that striking as a vehicle to put these guys on the ground, put these guys in very compromising positions, that would be a huge, huge tool. And I think that would easily propel them into the top five. I think they need to get those tools together, get the right coaching, get the right experience of getting that work done and understanding how to do that. But, you know, that's just going to take time. So we'll see how it goes.
But definitely Vieira is heading in the right direction after basically being labeled a one-dimensional fighter. He's definitely fixed it up a little bit, so you can at least have to make do with what he does. Like, you have to watch out for it. But his grappling is still that good that's going to be a problem no matter what. Oh, yeah. But let's move on to the third fight on the card. This shouldn't take long because it only lasted 1 minute. We had a lightweight matchup that saw Matheus Gamrot defeat Jeremy Stephens by first round submission. Gamrot moves to 19-1, 2-1 in the UFC, whereas Jeremy Stephens moves to 28-19, 15-18-1 in the UFC. What did you see in this matchup?
Man, this was a good matchup. It was a fast finish and a big statement for Gamrot. I mean, it happened so fast. The bell fucking went off, and then Gamrot just immediately shot in, went for like what looked like a single leg, but it wasn't a very successful single leg because he wasn't pulling into the legs or anything like that. But I think instead what he decided is like, well, maybe that the intent was to try a single leg and he fucked up, or the intent all along was to do like a more of like a wrestler's ankle pick sort of thing. Yeah. So once he got that ankle, he just wrapped it up, started controlling it, and he actually ended up kind of pulling out Stephen's leg out from underneath him, then just got on top, stayed patient, worked on him, and then finished by Kimura submission very, very quickly. Stephens didn't even get a chance to get back to his feet. So, I mean, it was a beautiful showing. Just a quick clinic on top side control for that Kimura lock, which that's one of the first top side Kimura locks you tend to learn in jiu-jitsu outside of like what you learn from front guard, the very basic one. Guy's got his hands on your chest, sweep out, sit up, grab the wrist, arm through, lay back, and pull over the back. That's the very first one you learn. The second one you learn is the one he's doing right there in that picture.
Yep.
And it's way more technical. Usually you learn it from like side control or mount sometimes, depending on who your teacher is. But yeah, I mean, the way he did it made it look super easy. So like that's saying something. I think he made a great statement there, and he definitely made a case for the top 15 matchup that he wanted. He didn't call out anybody specific that I heard. But he said, like, I want anybody top 15, so on and so forth. I think there's definitely some really cool matchups that can happen there. I would personally think the style matchups that'd be the funnest to watch would be Gregor Gillespie, Diego Ferreira, or Thiago Moises after he's had some time to recover. But, I mean, yeah, those would be a lot. Because Kevin Lee is moving over, so we can't really do that one. And I don't know anything about number 15. There's no way I'm going to say that fucking name, right?
To Sorkin.
Okay.
The only reason I know that is there's, I think his brother or somebody with the same last name fights in one. So I've heard them say it several times.
So you had the inside track.
yeah, definitely. But there's really not much for me to say because about a fight that lasted a minute and then you've already gone with it. It gets the quick takedown. Pressured him, kept him down, and then just capitalized on a small mistake. It got the Kimura lock for the victory. The only thing else I'm going to say after that was they interviewed Jeremy Stephens afterwards, and he said he wants to get a quick fight around. He wants to fight in the next month or two to get this bad taste out of his mouth because of losing in a minute. Stevens is one of the toughest fighters in the UFC, and his record doesn't show it because he has that many losses in the UFC. 18. He's below 500 when it comes to that. He's always floated around the featherweight, lightweight, even I believe bantamweight, but he, like, that doesn't take away from how tough the guy is, and he always puts on a show in his fights because he's not going to be easy, and it's just Gamrot took advantage of a situation and got the victory. I am intrigued by a matchup if they put it, book him against Gregor Gillespie. That would be very cool fight there because of the tendencies of both guys and what they bring to the table. Because, of course, Gillespie is a big-time wrestler, and he likes to pressure his guys, keep him down. But then you got Gamrot right here, and what he just did, that would just make for a banger of a fight. It'd probably be like maybe on a fight night, it might be like co-main event, maybe like the third fight. But it would definitely be a good matchup. If you have Makovec and Moises be a main event, there's no way that you couldn't make that a co-main event of like a similar type of a card. But Gamrot moves in the right direction, of course. His loss that he had before this was his only loss. So I think he definitely learned from that. And he's still young enough to where his rise has a lot to go for it. Whereas Stevens, I said before this fight, if they don't cut him now and they give him another fight, he probably should be cut now. But I think just with how much of a veteran he is, he somehow just gets by without getting cut. I don't know how. He's the one fighter. If you can have 18 losses in the UFC, you must be doing something to keep your job.
Yeah. I mean, he's lost three times more than he's won. So, I mean, that's...
Yeah.
Yikes.
Exactly. But he'll likely get booked. I'll say if he gets booked, he'll be in a spot on, like, the prelim somewhere and be plucked there as, like, the prelim headliner against somebody in that same range. Just keep a lookout for Gamrot in the future. Like we said, we think it's going to be Gamrot and Gillespie.
So I'm trying to find where he is in the rankings right now, and I can't seem to find him. That's really odd. Because, I mean, that's the thing. I this fight was so short. I haven't seen either of his other two fights, so I couldn't tell you what his stand-up looks like. Like, it was like he didn't even use it. So my other question would be like, well, maybe Brad Riddle might be an interesting guy if he's more of like a stand-up trainer usually. Yeah. But I don't know if that's even the case or if he really is just all about the grappling, because that's all he showed this time around. You know what I mean?
There it is. Gamrot is 14.
Oh, he's 14. Okay.
He's 14. Really? I guess the rank in MMA.
I guess they're gonna move shit.
Yeah. They just did this. So look for the UFC to do theirs, of course, tomorrow. Okay. But he is... he's 13 in the UFC, 14 overall. And he's right above Brad Riddell and right below Diego Ferreira and Gillespie.
Gotcha. So who did he beat the other time and who did he lose to? Because those are the only other two fights he's had in the UFC.
He lost to Kevin Lee. Oh, no. That's wrong guy. He lost to Guram to Lilatsve, and then he beat Scott Holtzman and then Jeremy Stevens.
Okay, I haven't heard of either of those other two guys. Scott Holtzman looks like he's got a 6-5 record somewhere in the 25 range. And then I don't even know. Oh, there he is. I see him. Guram. Jesus. There's no way I'm saying that name, but he's already booked. Yeah, but it looks like he's on a 1-0 streak, just that one victory by decision. So interesting.
Yeah. I think did he fight? See, it says here he was supposed to, he was supposed to fight and then he didn't. Okay, that makes sense now.
But he beat
Martins, Silva, and Gamrot, so So that just shows that he's doing well. But I just like we said, I don't see him fight Ferrer, Diego Ferrer, because he's booked with Grant Dawson in October. So yeah, that just makes it even more realistic that he's going to be fighting Gregor Gillespie in the future.
Yeah, I like that matchup. I wouldn't mind that. I wouldn't mind that at all.
Yep, but let's move on to the co-main event of the evening. On here, we have a women's bantamweight matchup, which saw the return of Miesha Tate after 4 years of being retired before deciding to come back. She had two kids and then wanted to come back. She wanted to get that itch to try and go for that title once again. In this matchup, she defeated Marion Reynaud by third round TKO. This was Marion Reynaud's retirement fight. She is 43, I believe.
44.
Oh, 44.
44, which is kind of nuts. That's old for UFC. Like, goddamn. Yeah.
But she comes in. She's coming in. She's been on a 4-fight losing streak, and she had said that it's time for her to retire. So it was kind of a nice way to have Miesha Tate come in after being retired and then Reynaud going in on the last fight. But Miesha Tate moves to 19-7, 6-4 in the UFC, and Marion Reynaud falls to 9-8-1, 5-7-1 in the UFC. What did you think of this fight?
Man, this was a really good showing, I think, for Miesha Tate after 5 years. That's pretty nuts. Yeah. But I also really like this fight because Reynaud was fighting. I like Reynaud. I know she hasn't had the best record or the best run, but like her story is really cool. You know, like she, just to put this into perspective, Cowboy Cerrone is 38 years old right now after a super long career in the UFC.
Yeah.
She started her career 2 years before, like 2 years back when Cerrone, she started when she was 36. So Cerrone's 38. Imagine if he started his career 2 years ago. Like, that's nuts, right? Like, holy shit. But she didn't even start a career. She started training at 36 and then worked her way up to fight in the UFC. And now at 44, she's finally retired. She didn't make it a full 10, but like, she started at an age where most fighters are like, all right, I got to start retiring. Like, this is it. I've reached the kind of old age for fighting, but she just powered through and that was awesome. And she really didn't let anything stop her. And that's such a cool story, especially for someone like me, who's considering getting back into, you know, doing MMA and competing, starting obviously at the amateur level. But hey, you know, if it goes well, I would love to fight competitively at the pro level. But like, I'm already thinking like, oh fuck, I'm already 27. Most guys are already like well on their way by the time they're 27. But I think, oh wait, fuck that. Renault was 36 when she started. Fuck that shit. I'll be fine. Like, yeah. it's all good. So that was really cool to kind of watch her close the chapter on this or close the book on this. And Miesha Tate, she just basically dominated for 3 rounds. It was amazing. There was a lot of like even exchanges on the feet. I would say in probably most of these rounds, they were kind of feeling each other out, trading back and forth, especially in the first. And you really didn't see a whole lot happen until like, you know, maybe the first minute and a half. Then Miesha Tate kind of started to take control a little bit, especially when they were doing the clinch work. The clinch work was, sometimes it was all Tate, sometimes they were just fucking each other up and it wasn't clear who was doing better. The clinch work was very, very close almost the entire fight. But Tate got very aggressive on the striking after the breakup on the first couple of clinches. And then she secured the takedown. That's something she did consistently throughout this fight, was secure those takedowns. And that was huge to her game plan, obviously being Miesha Tate.
Yep.
I mean, when she would get those takedowns, just like in the first, she just dominated Reynaud with topside control, and she just kept her down for the entire first round after that. I think she got her down maybe like halfway through, 3 minutes in, something like that. But it was all her after that. The second round, Tate was, again, kind of coming out guns blazing a little bit more emboldened after having all that control time. But Reynaud started to kind of fire back after about a minute and a half in. She kind of found her timing, found her rhythm a little bit, started to return fire. But again, Miesha Tate stopped her momentum and just got the takedown, and it was all heavy pressure, and she just couldn't do anything. She just didn't really have any good answers for Miesha Tate's pressure. And she was trying to kind of fight back from her back. And I think that was kind of the mistake she made, was she accepted the back position instead of trying to get to her feet. Cause she was like laying there doing her up kicks and stuff. She tried to go for that Kimura and she got really, really invested in that Kimura. But Misha Tate, all she did was just flatten her out with that reverse scarf hold and just kind of beat on her a little bit and just kind of completely stuffed the submission attempt. And then just worked right back into the side control position and then worked her ground and pound. And it was like, you know, Renaud wasn't even really like walking back, trying to get to the cage, do your cage walks, that sort of thing. She was just kind of accepting the position. And it was just another round of Misha Tate on top and Renaud on bottom, just trying to keep her head above water. And the third round, that's when it was all over. Misha Tate came out guns blazing, just pieces up Renaud for a couple of seconds early in the round, then secures another takedown, scrambles around, lands in that side control. And that was it. When she got to that side of control, she worked her, got to the back, finished via ground and pound. It was very, very efficient. Like what? 45 seconds. That's all it took. But she, when she's on, she's really on, but she kept saying she's here to maybe take the title back. I'm like, she got spanked real bad by Nunes last time they fought.
Yes, and then I had a discussion before when I did the preview on Thursday. Yeah. That was kind of a weird situation where I thought that she should have put off the surgery. Right before the fight, she had surgery on her nose, and Dana White had told her, maybe you should push this off until after the fight, and then I'll even pay for it. And then she was adamant about getting it done beforehand. And then that's how she got beat, was she got hit in the nose. And she might as well have crawled up in a ball because that had a big effect on her in that fight going forward. Yeah. And of course, it was what, 5-6 years ago?
Yeah, it was a while ago. I was going to say.
It's been retired for 4 years. But coming into this, here's a good trivia. How many knockouts does Misha Tate have in the UFC?
Doesn't she have like 8, I want to say?
This was her first knockout in the UFC.
Really? I thought she had... Oh, I'm thinking finishes. Does she have eight finishes?
She had finishes. This is her very first knockout. So for her to be off, off for 4 years, she came in great shape. She looked good. She did. And then her striking looked better. This could be like I'm not going to say a new improved Misha Tate, but for her to come in like this and then to get a finish, a TKO when she's not known for that. She's known for getting the fight to the ground and using the grappling and the submission game to victory. And that just adds another wrinkle into her game that fighters have to prepare for. I think after this win, I really do see a rematch between her and Holly Holm. I think that's what it's not exactly what I think should happen rank wise, but I think that's what the UFC is going to think. They're going to be like, okay, you're not ready for Nunes, of course, but they probably do think that she's ready for a top five matchup. And there might be interest from Holly Holm because Misha Tate took the title from Holly Holm. And maybe Holly Holm might be like, I want a little bit of revenge.
Yeah,
and it would be a good stylistic matchup in itself. So I could see that happening next for both fighters.
Yeah, I mean, that would be a good step because that was also her most recent victory before she lost to Nunes and then Pennington back-to-back, and that was her retirement after that. So, I mean... that would be a good place to revisit, just to kind of see if she can pull it off again. Let's see. Yeah, that one went to technical submission, and she managed to get it in the fifth. So she had to work on Holly Holm for a while in that fight. But, I mean, I don't know, because at the same time, Holly Holm has still been fighting all this time. She's been gaining all that experience. She's still been grinding out fight after fight. Like, let's see how many she's had. I think she's had somewhere in the neighborhood of 5. Let me check. Let's see. So here she is fighting Nunes, Megan Anderson. Oh, wow. This was a while ago. Okay. So Tate, she's had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 fights since then. She hasn't won. She's won as many as she's lost. So it's like 4-4. But I mean, that's experience no matter how you cut it, right? Like she's fought RDA, Shevchenko, Cyborg, Amanda Nunes, Pennington, like big names. And she, you know, win or lose, was learning and getting better from that. So I think this is also kind of an interesting point where, like, if we match these two up, it's not just to see if Misha Tate's still got it. It's also to see, like, well, how far has Holly Holmes come? So
exactly,
whoever wins this, I think, would be a good candidate for the next shot at Amanda Nunes, because they've both been spanked pretty solidly. Like, yeah, when Holmes lost to Nunes, she got knocked out in the first round at the 4-minute and 10-second mark. Like, quick. So both of these ladies got spanked real bad by the champ. I don't think anybody thinks that they're necessarily going to win. But at the same time, it's like, somebody's got to do it. Like, somebody's got to challenge. Otherwise, you're just going to sit there.
I honestly think that Holly Holm could be a very good challenge to Nunes. I think she just got caught in a bad spot because she was looking decent before that knockout right there. Mm-hmm. She was going toe-to-toe with her, and I think she's improved by then. But like, the only other person ahead of them is Jermaine Randamie, and we don't even know what's happening with her. I feel like she's been off for like 2 years. I think she took the Aspen Ladd thing of being off for 19 months, and Aspen Ladd is fighting this upcoming Saturday, so at least she is getting ready to fight. No one on with GRD, so...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's just been kind of sitting for a while, but I mean, I don't know, because I mean, we're literally scraping the bottom of the barrel. Like, who wants to fight Nunes? Hey, Juliana Pena, you want it? You're number six, and that doesn't make sense, but do you want it? Because fucking nobody else does.
You
want
to talk trash? Okay, you can have it.
Yeah, for real. That's like, all right.
That's all she had to do was talk trash about the fact that she wanted to beat her, and then they were like, oh, here you go. Next day, you get the next title shot, because it's like, like they're running out of people to do that. And they just signed somebody, I think, to the UFC. So I think you're going to probably see a lot of situations where they're going to sign to that. I think it's the bantamweight.
She rules over bantam and featherweight.
Yeah.
And sometimes the ladies, just depending on weight, will do either or.
And there's really nobody in the featherweight. They've said like this is going to be the last fight.
Six people in the featherweights.
So I could see a situation where they raid Invicta of their featherweight talent, and then go the Dana White Contender Series route to get more into there, so they can kind of try and stock new talent into there. So maybe by that time, either Nunes retires, and then they'll be like, okay, we can have somebody else here and actually have competitive fights again for the title, or maybe somebody moves their way up from that talent pool and dethrones her and then sets up something there. But
I would also think that they might do like a kind of like another Ultimate Fighter season where it's like devoted to building that division, kind of like they did with Gaethje in that season where they put together the women's flyweights, kind of like that. But you wouldn't need to seat the entire like 15 spots. You just need, like, you know, pair up the women's featherweight, recruit them from like LFA and PFL and stuff like that. And then maybe do like, I don't know, dudes welterweights. We haven't done that in a while, right? Yeah. It's been a while for the welterweight.
And that's a good point there, because that's basically how they built the strawweight. Flyweight or strawweight?
Well, the flyweights got an entire season just to build the division, and they were seeded like 1-16 and they fought.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, that would be an option.
Yeah, because that was good. Oh, yeah, because then they had the winner got the inaugural flyweight championship, because the finals was Rose and Esparza, who coincidentally now are ranked 1-3. Well, 1-3, because Rose is the champion right now. Mm-hmm. And then 2 is Zhang Weili. So that would be a really good idea for the next series, is to just devote it all to the featherweight division right now, and then to restock it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, like, it might also this be good one to ended look in at September. Some of the men's divisions that are a little light, yeah. They could kind of splice it because, I mean, you've got, because, I mean, technically what you could also do, it's an option. I don't know how much people would like it, but like, you've got some bigger women who tend to be like a little bit heavier. Maybe they might be like, oh, well, I mean, if featherweight's going to be like a division, I'll, you know, bulk up a little, fight a little heavier. You know, make a home in the featherweights if I know there's going to be more fighters coming in. That way you don't have to recruit as huge of a pool and devote an entire season. Because there's also some, like, dudes divisions that I think are a little light. Like, maybe the flyweights or the welterweights could use an ultimate fighter season to just kind of stock some people in there, put some good fighters up and coming. Because Usman is running out of people fast.
Yep.
I feel like there's just... The flyweights are not super, super loaded, and Brendan Moreno, I think, is going to run through people pretty quick, but I feel like maybe this top seven, oh, I'd say maybe top 10. These top 10 guys here are all pretty competitive, and they might kind of like all maybe trade the belt back and forth a little bit. Maybe someone will eventually come out as the top dog, but that's only 10 people in the division. Everybody else, it's like, it's a little light, you know? Mm-hmm. That might be a good place to start inserting some of these new guys, these up-and-comers who might, you know, be a real problem in that division. Start to get it loaded with the lightweights.
Yeah. And then there's that wild card that's always there. If Kayla Harrison wins the PFL tournament, she's teased that she's thinking about moving to Bellator or UFC. And in her one Invicta fight in November, she did fight at featherweight, which is the division we're talking about. So you never know. She can move over. Yeah. And since there's no lightweight division, she can move to featherweight and immediately challenge Amanda Nunes for the title, because I think that would be a banger of a fight. I think that's probably her biggest adversary since she already took out Chris Cyborg and sent her to the to Bellator. Since then, so I'm hoping that that's the case. I hope maybe if I get lucky. See, this would be crazy if they could do a little bit of both. Have like the Ultimate Fighter where they do like half of that division, featherweight division for the women's, and then do like you said, maybe a welterweight division for the men's, and then do that, and then bring in Kayla Harrison. You got the Kayla Harrison for the short term, gives you that kind of a mega fight right away, and then you can retool the division for the future. Yeah. That way, they don't do what they've been trying to do and get rid of that division. Because I think if they get rid of featherweight, that would be the wrong move. I think that would, you're just going to deplete the women's side anymore, and it'll just cut down to three divisions total: the flyweight, strawweight, and bantamweight. And I think they're going to need that featherweight. So play the long game with it, and then do whatever you can to lure Harrison over. And then retool that with the season of the Ultimate Fighter, and then it'll be worth it in the end.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. If they get rid of the featherweight division, you're going to have three divisions. Two of them are basically like nobody's taken that title for a while. You got one division that's competitive, but it's competitive to, like, I don't know, maybe the top, let's see, top six, give or take.
Yeah.
Everybody below that, I'm like, I don't know. You'd need a lot of training to really be a threat. But like top six and everybody else just kind of floats is not a very compelling division. Yeah. And the other two divisions, like, it's just all the women fighting each other. And then sometimes they'll go and try to fight the champ and lose and then be like, well, we knew that was going to happen. So at least with the featherweight division, it would open up like a new frontier. There would be new exciting matchups to be made. And with Kayla Harrison, that's basically what they did with Megan Anderson to fight Amanda Nunes. So why the fuck not? You know, like, I mean, they're just hungry for competitors at this point. But I think they need to start expanding out the divisions, not just trying to consolidate, because then it's just going to get boring. Everything's going to be like, oh, well, we all know how this is going to go. You know.
Yeah. And then the UFC, not to prolong this, but the UFC is the only, well, UFC and Bellator, but I'm surprised they haven't tried to add an atomweight division at all, considering there is a good crop of atomweights out there. You got Invicta, who they like to pluck a lot of women from. They got a really good atomweight division. You got one championship that has a really strong atom weight division. They're supposed to be finally getting that atom weight Grand Prix started there, since it was supposed to go on in May and then it got postponed due to COVID there. But with this, just like you said, instead of trying, because they need to push it out and add more to it, and then with that, you can get a lot of fluctuating between the divisions. Well, oh, maybe I've been fighting this division. Maybe I can go down here, up here, because there's more options. Right now, I feel like they think they're closed in because there's only 3-4 options, and they're trying to get rid of this one. So then there's only three. And then between the three of those, you got Rose Whaley at this division, and you got Shevchenko at this one, and then you got Nunez at this one. So it's kind of like killing the women's division that way. Whereas when it first started, you had Ronda Rousey, but then you were able to kind of add to that because she was kind of the only face at the time. Right. But now you got three faces, and they're dying the divisions. And maybe you should add more to then kind of give them more matchups and more division changes.
Right. Yeah. But I kind of circle back. The other matchups I thought would be interesting for Tate, just because a lot of those women are already booked pretty solid. And she is starting at like the number 12 spot. Holly Holmes is 3. So I don't know if you necessarily can justify that big of a jump. They might do it anyway, but it'd be a little weird. Whereas Lena Landsberg is free, and Yuna Kunitskaya needs some recovery time, but she'd be free pretty quickly. Maybe one of those two matchups. I think with Kunitskaya, that would be an interesting fight, because Kunitskaya does do like the sambo style wrestling sometimes. She does love to stand and bang. So it's kind of like the Russian flavor of Misha Tate in a lot of ways, or at least the Misha Tate we saw on Saturday. So I think that might be a cool fight to see.
Yeah, because the couple of people that she has in far, and then you can kind of prolong her rise back up to fight the likes of Holmes and Nunez. It gives her a little bit more time to get acclimated, because this fight, she looked great, and it was just a return. Imagine this and do something like that to a fighter like Kunitskaya, who like has been flowing around that. I'm calling her the gatekeeper now, that division, because she should be up higher, but for some reason she never gets anything going. It's like win, loss, win, loss. And then she stays at that 5-7 range now and doesn't move any forward. So I could see that happening as well, especially since she just fought a week or two ago, so it'll be perfect timing for them to book it.
Oh yeah.
But let's move away from the co-main event and move on to the main event of the evening. Right here, we had a lightweight matchup that saw Islam Makhachev pick up a fourth round submission victory over his opponent Thiago Moises. In this matchup, Makhachev moved to 20-1, 9-1 in the UFC. And Thiago Moises falls to 15-5, 4-3 in the UFC. What did you think of this main event?
I mean, this was pretty much what everybody expected, I think. Makhachev pretty much dominated the fight, but, you know, Moises had his moments. Like in the first, Makhachev, one thing he did really well throughout this entire fight, but he did right away at the beginning of the first, was walk down Moises and have him like up against the cage pretty much and just kind of trying to problem solve from there. And the commentators made a really good point. I think it was Bisping who said, like, look, if he shoots, then Moises can't sprawl now. So like, what's he going to do to defend those takedowns that you know are coming? But I mean, Makhachev is just that intimidating that Moises just backed off immediately and hit the cage. So, I mean, they went back and forth on the feet, which is interesting because that's something that Khabib was not always great at, was the striking. His striking was largely ornamental to get to the grappling, right? And then, you know, if he would win by like a TKO or something, it's because he'd wore you down over the course of many rounds and then would, you know, finish you via ground and pound or something like that. But you know, most of his stuff was like submission wise. That was his thing. He wasn't really the guy who had like the stunning knockout reel, right? He was the guy who had the choking out reel. But Makhachev is looking like he might be a better striker than Khabib was. Like he looks more confident with his hands, especially with a guy like Moises, who is a power striker. He's a powerful guy. And I mean, you know, Moises would keep forcing these wrestling situations, which I don't know why he did that. That was dumb. I did it in the first. He did it again in the second. And they largely wouldn't go anywhere. They didn't work in his favor too much. But again, another thing that Makhachev was really good at was working that clinch. He would be throwing those knees, looking for opportunities to wear down with striking in a way that, you know, we don't really remember too much from Khabib as much. He was really more the guy trying to break you down with his grappling acumen and his abilities there. But I mean, Makhachev stayed patient, and you know, he worked those striking exchanges, worked Moises in the clinch in the wrestling situations, and you know, he got his takedowns when he wanted them. The first round was probably the one that took the longest. Took him 4 minutes to get a takedown there. Maintained a lot of topside pressure after that, got some good ground and pound in the front guard all the way to the end of the round. Then when he came out in the second, Moises was a little bit more aggressive. I think he was kind of upset about what happened at the end of the first. Scored some shots on Makhachev, but I mean, Makhachev's got a good chin on him. Yeah. He was able to return fire with some solid kicks. Again, Moises kept, you know, doing these wrestling exchanges where he would pressure in, but the second round was the only time where it paid off when he got that takedown, but it didn't really do anything for him because Makhachev pretty much immediately reversed the situation and took Moises's back and then just worked on him for the rest of the round. Right up until that last moment where he tried to attempt the armbar, but he ran out of time. But again, after that, Moises was a lot more reserved in the third. He was like, oh shit, I just got my ass handed to me in that second round. But I think he was being too hesitant. Like, that's the thing. And the commentators were saying this. I think going forward, anybody who fights Makhachev, you got to go first. Because if you're trying to do the counterattack, or if you're too hesitant, you're just playing into his game, which is, I'm going to wait, kind of piece you apart with the hands, and then shoot in, get my takedown, and work you on the ground in that very unique Sambo style. And, you know, that's pretty much what happened. You know, they got into some wrestling exchanges against the cage. And of course, Makhachev got that huge takedown where he just picks up Moises, changes a leg and goes to slam him. But Moises was able to stop the big slam noise. But I mean, he got another takedown after that, I'm pretty sure, after the little bit of clinch work. Makhachev got that. It was like a leg sweep. Like a judo throw almost, where he kind of kicked the legs out. Moises got right back up, but that's like two takedowns right there. A lot of solid control time on the ground, some clinch work. It was obvious that was Makhachev's round. Like all of these. The only time Moises got ahead a little in the fourth was that heel hook attempt, but he was out of position. He couldn't get it. So Makhachev just kind of waited him out. Like, all right, keep trying. Keep going, buddy. You got 20 seconds. We'll see if you can do it, but he couldn't. And then in the fifth, he just finished it. You know, Moises came out guns blazing, but Makhachev shut him down. Oh, yeah, fourth. You're right. Yeah, fourth. Yeah. Makhachev just shut him down immediately, and he just scared him back up against the cage, got that big takedown, comes to the top side control in the guard, just works his way to the back and finished him with the rear naked choke. Just a very dominant performance. He made it look like Thiago Moises really didn't know what he was doing out there, which normally Thiago Moises looks good. It's just he was outclassed this time. Yeah. And, you know, Makhachev was saying, like, he's having trouble finding a fight because everybody's ducking him. Nobody wants to fight him. That's why, because he's really fucking good. Of course, nobody wants to step into the cage and lose their spot to this guy.
Well, so, I think they may have another matchup on their hand because they did show that Dan Hooker tweeted out Makovich afterwards. And I think.
Really? Okay.
And then he's right above Makovich in the rankings, so that's the fight the book right there. I don't think it's going to end well for Hooker, but you know, it's a good step up in competition for Makhachev, where he's actually going to face somebody above him. But let me just say,
call out RDA, which I wouldn't mind seeing that matchup because RDA has more of like that grappling pedigree, so he could like hold his own. Yeah. But I mean, I don't know. I thought either RDA or Tony Ferguson, one of those two, needs to go on the chopping block.
Right? I'd rather see him do a guy like Hooker, where he's like a brawler and he just goes out, and that's just like you said, you need to go at Makhachev, and Hooker is the guy that will go at him. I think at this stage, we don't know what to expect from Ferguson. He hasn't been doing that. And then that's not Dos Anjos' style. He's more of a grappler. But Hooker is a guy, he's going to stand up, go at you and throw strikes at you and just keep coming. And that would be a good thing for Makovich to try and dominate and then move past and put eyes on you. Because then it's like, okay, the one thing that you have to improve on is guys coming at you. And if he destroys them, that's just even better for him. But let me say that in the preview video that I had here, I had Islam Makovic by round 4 submission. So I feel pretty good with that. I knew he was going to get that submission because that's how he's been winning. Like, mm-hmm. he likes to get the guys down. And one of his patented moves is to lock up the legs. Like, he wraps himself on the legs.
Oh, yeah.
And then he puts his arm on your throat. And then he just winds up grinding you out. And then he winds up submission. And then he just kept taking Moises down. Moises should have done a little bit more of the kicking game and then kind of used distance on his side. And then he did have a little bit of success on the fence, they were saying early on. And Makovich, they were saying Makovich was being a little bit too sloppy, but then he was able to get going. I think Moises allowed him too much time to get into rhythm.
Yeah.
And then, just like you said, I think not being too in his face was his downfall. Because if he would have went in his face, threw a lot of kicks, and then kept pressuring him, it would have made the fight more interesting. But he just made it easy for Makovich to get going by being too timid. And then that's why Makovich dominated the fight.
Yeah. Yeah, I just want to see him get a matchup where they can't deny him a top five fight. Like, this is getting ridiculous.
Well, you know, he's going to be the future. You know, eventually it's going to be him and Oliveira, which would be just amazing. Right. The submission grappling against this guy who's just the Sambo style with the grappling. It's just it makes for a hell of a fight. And then they would just keep going at each other. Like, he could do this, but then Oliveira can find that small way out of it and then try and get like a renegade choke on Makovich. And then they'll probably just be rolling around the whole fight. They won't even be standing up at all. But it looked good. It was good to see Makovich get this. He technically does get that top 15 win there. And then just like I said before, he did the UFC favor with this one, so now they got to do a favor and make sure that his next fight is above. And I think that's where maybe you could see Dos Anjos. Maybe he'll be like, "Give me him because he's in the
top." He's number six. Like,
yeah,
he's up
number
there.
Six. So he's just on that cusp of the top five. But they could be like, "Okay, beat RDA, and if you win, then you're top five there." Now then you go after those big guns there, because that top five has really good names. And then it just gives you the future of maybe Islam against Dustin Poirier, maybe him against Gaethje, then him against Oliveira. It just has endless possibilities.
Well, specifically because Dariush took the year off. Yeah. That might be a good entrance in for Makhachev. Is like, well, this guy wasn't taking it seriously enough to, you know, fight his, you know, take advantage of the fact that he's number three in the division. He's in line for a title shot, but he's like, nah, I'm just going to take the rest of the year off. All right, motherfucker, prove yourself again. You know, take Makhachev, see how you do. Because Dariush is another guy who's really good at, like, the grappling and the submission game. So
I was just going to say, watch them throw a curveball and be like, okay, we're going to do Makhachev versus Dariush.
Yeah, just throw a curveball right there. I understand it. Fuck yeah. Like, I mean, if he's going to just take the year off and fucking logjam the division like that, then, I mean, give someone a chance who's hungry, you know? Like, it makes sense.
But before we get ready to go on this episode, we're going to do a recap of Tough Episode 7, if you want to get started with that, Miles.
Oh, yeah. This was a pretty good – this is actually probably my favorite Ultimate Fighter episode we've had so far. This one was fucking great. This was solid. So this week we saw a fight between Brady Heistand. I keep not knowing how to fucking say that name, and it's not even that complicated. I'm going to say Heistand. from Team Ortega, or sorry, from Team Volkanovski, and Josh Reddinghouse from Team Ortega. And like I said, this was a fucking banger. And this episode, again, it was like all about the fighters too. So drama wise, there's really not much to report. Turquios and Argata, they're still friends. That's pretty much it. Like that's Argata's not taking his loss very hard. He's being a good guy about it, which makes Mitch Raposo the biggest bitch in the house. I'll say it again.
I was going to say
he's the only one. He's the only one. But anyway, so Josh and Brady are apparently longtime friends and training partners because they come from the same town. They're both from Spokane, Washington. So they kind of knew a good deal about each other's game even before they were on the show. Specifically their grappling game when they were in the hot tub cutting weight. They were talking and they were like, hey, have we ever like sparred? And Brady was like, well, I mean, we haven't done like stand up, but we've done a lot of grappling, right? And they're like, Oh, yeah. So they had an idea of what each other's grappling game looked like going into this fight. Now, Ortega pushed Josh to take this fight with Brady to kind of push him out of his comfort zone a little bit and be like, look, man, this is what this show is. You got to set your friendship aside and, you know, go out there and bang. And this was a really good matchup stylistically too, because of, again, how close these guys are in terms of like who they've trained with, what their style is, what their preferred approach is. It's so close. I'd say Josh has a lot more experience than Brady though, but I think Brady has the benefit of more experienced training partners. So Josh is 31. He's a little, you know, older for a fighter, which again, just think of Renault. Then all of a sudden that's not old at all. 31, fucking he can do some shit, you know?
Yeah.
But he has a ton of fighting experience out of, I think mostly King of the Cage, which is a smaller pro league, but he had a number of really big fights out of there. He works as a CPA and accountant as his day job. He had some wrestling experience coming out of high school, apparently. And he went straight into MMA after that. He trains out of Warrior Camp MMA, which I haven't heard of before. It might be an unknown gym as of now, but that's where he fights out of. His pro record is 16-5, which is really solid record. Goddamn. Brady, on the other hand, has less experience, obviously. He's the younger of the two. He's also fought out of a less well-known league, Conquest of the Cage. It might be more of like a regional pro league. Yes. Like I haven't even heard of that one. He's a volunteer firefighter and he lives out of the fire station. He does train now, however, out of Sick Jitsu. And as we've seen in previous episodes, he trains with Michael Chiesa, who is a longtime partner of his in the gym. His pro record is 5-1, which is good, but he's still green, of course. Now, when it comes to this fight, unpopular opinion, I think that Brady stole this fight. I think he stole it. I do. I think he stole this fight from Josh. So, like, in the first round, Brady comes out, and he's swinging for the hills, right? And he got Josh up against the cage. He got him a few times. He definitely tagged him. And Josh recovered really well, and he went on the offensive in turn. And he was able to keep Brady under control, mostly with the striking, but also with some of his wrestling, able to kind of, like, fend him off a little bit. Then about a minute and a half into the fight, Brady was able to kind of turn the tide with his wrestling exchanges and get a takedown. And then, of course, take Josh's back. He got very close to submitting Josh, but he was able to problem solve his way out and got back to the feet and secured a throw of his own. So takedown wise, it's 1-1. He took Brady's back and actually got, a second throw in there. So it was 2-1 on the takedowns, but he wasn't able to control Brady. So all the control time went to Brady. The stand-up exchanges were so brief, but I think Josh was a little ahead on the stand-up. But overall, because of that control time, I think, you know, you have to give it to Brady in that first round.
Yeah.
But Josh came out in the second, and he just tuned that boy up on the stand-up. Like, he was fucking him up on the striking exchanges. He's such a technical striker. He literally was getting that, like, slip uppercut down the middle every fucking time. He was nailing it. Same thing with the knees. Anything up the middle, it was like Brady couldn't see it, and he just kept getting caught consistently with it. And it just shows you how technical Josh is on the hands. And he's a pretty technical guy on the ground too, because again, he was able to problem solve his way out of some really dangerous situations. And I think that's why he took the second, even though Brady was using his wrestling and kind of riding Josh's back to stay in the fight. But I think it was just too much of a difference in the stand-up for the judges to give it to Brady. So it was 1-1. And of course, Volkanovski was like, what? There's another round? Fuck. All right. Because Brady was pretty beaten up at that point. He did not look like he was ready to go a third. And again, this is that third round is why I think Brady kind of stole it. And it should have gone to Josh, because in my opinion, it went a lot closer to the way the second round went than it did the first. Because, man, in those stand-up exchanges, which did account for a decent amount of fight time, you know, Josh was just piecing Brady up again on the feet. He managed to secure a takedown, got a little bit of topside control, and about 3 minutes in, Brady was able to secure a takedown of his own and kind of push his wrestling to stay in the fight. And that was really all he had was that wrestling, because if it went to the hands, he was just getting fucked up. So he was like, oh shit, I got to fucking wrestle. And even the coaches were like, I think he had his back at one point, and Volkanovski's like, you got his back. You just hang in there for another minute. You got this. Like, that's all he could do. Cause he knew if it went back to the stand-up, he had no chance.
Yeah.
And I mean, Josh, he was tired, but he was still, you know, peppering Brady with the punches during the wrestling exchanges. He was still working him when it went to the ground. Brady was able to stay on Josh and get a second takedown in the third. But again, Josh was just racking up the significant strikes on the cards and just becoming such a problem for Brady. I think the mistake he made was at the end of the third, he tried to do like a bit of a sacrificial takedown where like, Brady was on his back. So what he tried to do is he tried to roll through and either like capture a leg or maybe get into a scramble to get a better position. But instead what ended up happening is Brady just kind of, you know, didn't hold on the way he thought he would. So he just kind of landed into front guard and Josh was just fucking him up with elbows from the bottom side in the front guard up until the end of the round. But I think the judges saw, lastly, they saw Brady on top, Josh on bottom, even though Brady was eating elbows and shit. Mm-hmm. I think that kind of colored their perception of how that third round went. So, yeah, Brady got the decision 2-1, because I guess, you know, judges were watching a different fight or whatever. But so he's moving on to the semifinals. And honestly, out of all of the Team Volkanovski guys who have won so far, he's probably the one who looks like the biggest threat. Like, he looks like he could actually put up a fight against some of these Team Ortega semifinalists. I think Brady would be a bad matchup for Ludwig, because Ludwig's got all that wrestling experience, but he's easily seduced by like, he wants to stand and trade.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, even though he was like with Mitch Raposo, he shouldn't have, but he did anyway, because he loves to do it. And Mitch Raposo was just out striking him that whole first round. And I think he'll fall into that trap again with Brady, but I think Brady's got the length, he's got strength. And when it goes to the wrestling, I think that would still be a little bit more in Ludwig's favor. But I think Brady would definitely be a bigger problem for him than Mitch Raposo was, because Mitch Raposo had no answers when it came to Ludwig's wrestling. So it would be a new challenge for him. As far as matching up Brady against Vince Murdoch, that's a closer one, because I think Vince Murdoch's got him on the hands. I think if this goes to like a slugfest, I'd put my money still on Murdoch, because he's, again, just as technical as Josh. And we saw in this fight that Brady has those gaps in his stand-up game to where a more technical fighter could take advantage. But I think Vince also is more powerful in terms of striking power than Josh Rittenhouse is. So I think if it came to it, I think Murdoch could slip in those shots and they would count for a lot more when they connected. So that would be an interesting matchup, because I know Vince also has a decent like wrestling ground background, even though we didn't see it in the fight he had with Lampros, because he knocked him out so fast. So that'd be an interesting kind of matchup to challenge Murdoch a little bit, see if he's as well-rounded as, you know, his experience would indicate. But yeah, I think he's maybe the first guy from Team Volkanovski to be a real threat in the semifinals. Because the other guys, not so much. But yeah, next tomorrow, we've got our last prelims fight. I guess technically today, because we're pre-recording it, you guys are watching from the future. So tomorrow for us, today for you guys, we've got our last prelims matchup between Gilbert Urbina. I definitely said that wrong. From Team Volkanovski and Miles Hunsinger from Team Ortega. We'll chat about that, of course, next week and talk about how the fight went. And at that point, we'll have been done with all these prelims matchups. So I also want to give you guys my preferred matchups for the rest of that finale card, just based on the prelims. Probably just give one of my preferred matchups, because again, we have to see how the semifinals go, see who loses. Because usually there's like, what, three slots for matchups before the, because we've got two divisions we got to do. So that's the main and the co-main. So we got to fill up three more fights. So I'll give you my first preferred matchup based on the guys who have lost in the prelims so far, who I'd want to see on the finale card. More on that next week.
Nice, nice. Yeah. Yep. But again, to the end, of course, next week we will be, of course, reviewing UFC Vegas Sanhagen versus Dillashaw. So check out this Thursday as me and a special guest of mine, New Jersey Insight, will be previewing UFC Fight Night / Vegas 32, Sanhagen versus Dillashaw. Like I just said, that will be out noon on Thursday. We got a six fight main card here. That card itself is actually coming on pretty early. I believe it starts at 4 p.m. Eastern time, so it'll be 3 p.m. Eastern
over here.
So you're getting a nice early prelim start for that one, and that card is loaded for being a fight night on ESPN Plus. So look out for that preview video that we have coming out. And then, as always, with that, with the recap, we're just like you said, next week we're going to be recapping that and recapping episode 8 of The Ultimate Fighter right now. I can't wait until they get that done so we can see these semifinal matchups, and then we'll get whittled down to see who's in the finals. And then that just means once that's done, that means we're almost there to Ortega Volkanovski, which is going to be at the end of September. For that one, with how the season's been, I can't wait for that one, because I know Volkanovski is getting tired of Brian Ortega right now.
bickery.
Yeah, but before we get going, I just want to get a shout out to our sponsors. Their first one is 99 Jersey. Use promo code SportsBoxShow20 at checkout to receive 20% off your next purchase. We got Odds Jam. Just go to the link in the bio of this video. Click it, sign up to Odds Jam, and watch as you'll never lose a bet again. And then we got High Tide Herbal. Use promo code CAGEMYIQ10 at checkout to receive 10% off your next purchase. High Tide Herbal is a company owned by coaches and athletes who specialize in speedy recovery. Their products have CBD oil in them, and the goal is for quick recovery. So once again, go to www.hightideherbal.com, put the promo code CAGEMYIQ10 in the spot, and watch as you get 10% off. But that will wrap things up for this fight night recap that was headlined by Makovec versus Moises. As always, I'm your host, D-Bake. This is my co-host, Miles Long, and we hope you guys have a wonderful rest of your week.
Yep. See you guys.
Yep. Talk to you guys later.